Take a network break, grab a virtual donut, and join us for our weekly romp through the networking and IT news. Just a little bit of business before we dive in. Our first sponsor today is Pilot Fiber. They're an ISP that actually cares about customers. Pricing is all-inclusive, no contracts, fast setup and installation, local support and construction teams, friendly neighborhood internet experts. And by the way, Pilot's looking for technical pros who share their passion for driving an unprecedented end-to-end experience. You can find out more at pilotfiber.com/packetpushers. We're also sponsored today by Thousand Eyes. They give you performance visibility from every user to every app over any network, internal and external, so you can migrate to the cloud, troubleshoot faster, and deliver exceptional user experience. Sign up for a free account at thousandeyes.com/packetpushers. Last but not least, stick around after the news. We have a sponsored Tech Bytes conversation with Silver Peak. We're going to be talking SD-WAN with their customer, the Vitech Group, about their global SD-WAN rollout, how they're migrating off MPLS, and the changes they're getting in application performance. So stick around for that.
I love these stories because the big thing about this is nobody believes that you can do SD-WAN without being on MPLS. It's like there's like an addiction to MPLS out there. And every time we talk to these customers, whether from Silver Peak or others, but usually Silver Peak, they're like, no, we found the internet or the public WAN is better than MPLS. And I had this discussion this week, actually. And the point I was trying to make to people was, if you remember back in the day, the only network you could build was a private WAN. You had no choice. Mm-hmm. If you were to build a network today knowing nothing about what happened 30 years ago, you would just use the internet first because that's the obvious thing to use, right?
Right.
So anybody who says, oh, well, we have to use MPLS, I'm like, no, you're not thinking about the problem right. So that's what I love about these stories, these TechBytes conversations where we have customers, is because they often tell it not the way you're thinking about it.
Absolutely. And it's great to hear the customer perspective because they often are very clear that, yes, one of the first things we wanted to do was get off these private links. They wanted to get them off them as fast as they could because, maybe the service was fine, but the dealing with the telcos wasn't great. Performance wasn't always fantastic. So, the internet is real. Yes, you can do it.
And the interesting thing is the telcos are beginning to reap the seed that they sowed over the last 10 years. Up until now, you were stuck with private WAN and you didn't have a choice, so you just kind of sucked it up. And now we got choices. Guess what's happening?
Competition at work.
That's what we love to see.
All right. Well, before we get into the news, because we didn't do FUs last week for our Thanksgiving analyst episode, we've got a whole bunch stacked up. So we're going to run through quite a few. Let's start with the first. A listener wrote in to say we had discussed the JEDI contract. This is where Microsoft won a deal over Amazon and others to provide cloud services to the Pentagon. Greg, I think, probably did a little bit of commenting on how Microsoft doesn't have a great reputation for product quality. And this generated some thoughts from this person who, in fact, was listening on the road and had to pull over to write this FU.
I love it when people just react immediately. This is great stuff. And thanks very much for sending it in. We haven't put your details out because we like to keep it anonymous. And he's making the point, I think, if I can boil down the quite long follow-up that he gave us, which is great. He was saying, like, for example, Hyper-V 2019 is a very solid Type 1 hypervisor. And they've caught up with VMware and got the converged Ethernet and all that sort of stuff. And it's included in their licensing and it's actually able to replicate in the OS. So he's sort of saying that Hyper-V is in 2019 is actually pretty good. Well, I agree with that, actually. I've heard a lot of people say that. The problem is that it took them a decade to get there, long after they should have. And if you've been a customer of Hyper-V over that last, say, 5 to 10 years of virtualization, you shouldn't have had to wait. It should have been good at least 5 years ago, if not longer. Mm-hmm. Is that, you know, it's not unreasonable to expect if they want to compete with companies like VMware, then they have to do it at least as well as, not come 5 years late to, oh, we finally got a product that works and does all the things it's supposed to do and it's reliable.
Yeah, sure. Given the ferocity of the competition around the hypervisor market, especially mm-hmm. over the past 10 years when it was so critical for the way applications were mm-hmm. being developed and all the benefits you get with a hypervisor, for Microsoft to slack in that area was a misstep.
Perhaps one of the keys about VMware winning in the hypervisor market is they did have a really good quality product. It didn't blow up at random intervals. The car didn't stop and just, blow a foo-foo valve and have to be restarted all the time. They didn't go and bunk a whole lot of features into it. They kept the product. The ESX hypervisor is still pretty basic, and they didn't fill it up. But then he also goes on to say, we'd still have to deal with Windows licensing, and he has massive problems with their update process. And then he talks, the old Windows Server clustering is not well done compared to vSphere. Certified hardware from manufacturers is no longer available. They're only sold in bundles now, so they can't do it self-assembling. You can't build your own Azure Stack type of idea. And of course, licensing is now very confusing. I would put it to you that Microsoft's licensing has never been very simple or usable. And he's also highlighting that people are basically being bullied into going to Azure by making the licensing confusing and expensive on-prem. My point would be, and then he goes on to talk more about how Exchange is sort of getting better, but mostly they just want you to move to Office 365. So I guess my point would be, and maybe I didn't make it very well last time, is that Microsoft is like a tiger that can't change its stripes. It's a company with a long history of poor quality products, and that's its nature. And it has also a nature of avoiding reliability or avoiding fixing bugs or avoiding the internal processes that make this fixable. And to date, Microsoft hasn't changed my opinions that their products are not second rate. I believe them to be unfit for purpose. And while I think the company culture has improved, they're still pumping out bugs and even more security weaknesses in the Azure cloud than the other cloud providers. So I still believe that Microsoft Windows is fundamentally a crime scene. We see so many people where Windows is just taken over, subject to ransomware. Nobody seems to be able to fix it, least of all Microsoft, who really should bear responsibility for shipping what is fundamentally a faulty product. So, yeah, there might be a couple of products in a very large portfolio, but at the end of the day, a couple of good apples doesn't improve a bad barrel. I would be very dubious. And what amazes me overall is that customers continue to buy Microsoft products in face of obvious evidence that it's just not fit for purpose and the company hasn't changed its stripes.
It's hard to defend Microsoft, particularly back when they were the dominant OS vendor back in the day. Given that that has changed considerably, I think they've done a slightly better job. They've taken security more seriously. You can still complain about their software quality, absolutely. I do think they've recognized that they had a software issue, particularly around security. They've been better about updating and Patch Tuesday and all that. And I think they're actually being very proactive in their transition to the cloud. They're recognizing that Windows doesn't dominate anymore. There, I think in terms of the tiger changing its stripes, I'd say they are in the terms of their pivot to the cloud. Whether the software quality is better, you can debate.
Yeah, and I would extend my perspective to all of the legendary vendors, Cisco, Dell, HPE, IBM. All of those vendors have a fairly casual attitude towards, often the truth. They won't often admit to their faults. And secondly, their product quality continues to be less than excellent. And this is where open source's success has been prominent here, is because they've been willing to admit to their mistakes. It's transparent. You know when a bug's going to be fixed, or even if it's never going to be fixed, you know. And increasingly, the vendors are clamming up and hiding behind their brand names and trying to protect themselves from negative attitudes, when really they should go the other way. But, in this case, we're just targeting Microsoft, and I think my criticism remains valid within the framework of what I've just said.
Yeah, I think so.
But I also agree with you, Drew. They've got better, but whether a tiger can change its stripes, maybe.
It's getting deep. One of the comments that we got in the FU was that they were looking forward to the next VDC. That's a virtual design clinic, which was a live event we've been doing. So speaking of live events, we've got another one coming up.
We have. There's a Packet Pushers Holiday Edition. It's not a virtual design clinic. It's more of a chat session. It's becoming more of a therapy session, really, isn't it?
We'll have a couch. You can come in and...
Yeah, watch in. You can jump in. It's going to be streamed live on YouTube. So you can go over to YouTube and set a reminder there if you've got a YouTube account. It's going to be on December the 18th, 1800 hours British, 1300 hours Eastern Standard, and 1000 hours Pacific. I'm sorry for people in Australia and the Pacific regions. It's just very difficult for us to find a time that works for them. But it will be recorded and published up onto YouTube in pieces. So what we do is stream it live, and then we'll chunk it up into 15-minute chunks per topic so that it's easier to watch and consume during your lunch breaks at work.
That's right. It's going to run for about an hour and a half, so you can pop in anytime. If you can't make the whole thing, that's fine. We're going to have some guests. We're going to just have sort of like a sitting around the bar in the hallway track at a conference kind of conversations.
That's the idea behind it.
Fantastic.
Oh, and one other thing. I'm trying to put out a survey that asks questions. I've had a few questions come in from people. And if you've got questions or survey questions that you'd like to see asked, like, how many people love modern licensing schemes, for example, might be a good one, then hand them over. Go to packetpushers.net/FU and send them to us as follow-up.
Fantastic. Another FU, a couple of episodes ago, we talked about Microsoft getting on board with DNS over HTTPS, aka DOE, and a listener wrote in with three comments. One, he thinks they're just jumping on the train from Google and Mozilla, and it's going to be easy for them to do because Edge is basically Chromium, which is run by Google, and Google is going with DOH. Telcos are trying to fight it. There's a couple of news stories out there. One he referenced with UK telcos calling Firefox a villain, and here in the United States, some big ISPs went to Congress and said, hey, have you seen what Google's doing with DNS and how they want to take it over? Which started to raise some eyebrows. So some politicking going on as well.
Yeah, which is weird to me because at the end of the day, if these ISPs just upgraded their DNS, it wouldn't be a problem. You know, because once DNS over HTTPS is implemented on their DNS servers, they still have access to the data. Is it really that painful to, like, keep up with the times on upgrading your DNS servers? Is that such a trauma? I don't understand why they would be objecting unless they're actually doing stuff in the network. So, indeed, one of the things I saw this week is that a lot of people are turning their routers into security appliances. Mm-hmm. The Flow engines and the Flow security and the ability to dynamically update the access lists, especially by software, means that a lot of them appear to be using DNS inspection at the edge of the network to prevent security, so to do blocking at the edge. And in the case of some countries, like the UK, for example, they actually the ISPs are actually required to block certain websites specifically related to child pornography or, you know, really the worst of the internet. Mm-hmm. And they're going to lose the ability to do that until they update their DNSs, which is, of course, forcing them to update their DNSs. And they're so unhappy about that that they're going to whine to government that they don't want to do their job. So just, I can't make sense of this.
Now, that was the point. I mean, one of the issues that we're hearing about DOH is that it could potentially concentrate DNS powers in those such as Google who are running DOH compatible servers. But Google's counterargument is upgrade to DOH and then you can do it too, you know, which I guess is a fair argument.
Which is, exactly. And that I don't understand why this is such a big deal. The point here is that, and I've said this before, so I'll repeat it here, is DNS was unencrypted from the get-go because encryption was hard. Today, encryption is not hard, and we need to protect the user from the internet, from the bad actors. And so encrypting DNS is a natural behavior now that it's possible to do so. And that's what we're doing. This is not to be unexpected. We've encrypted everything else. HTTPS is all encrypted. You know, all of our file transfers encrypted over SSH. As it became practical to do so, this is what we've done. So lashing back against what is a natural industry trend is not defensible in my view.
Yeah. So we had another follow-up, a person who's, it sounds like sort of coming down pro DOH, who included some links. We'll make sure those get into the show notes. We thank everybody who's reaching out with follow-up, whether for corrections or additional information or just to ask questions. This is good stuff. We love the interaction.
Yeah. So this is highlighting the difference between DNS over HTTPS and DNSSEC. They're not exclusive, and in fact, they cooperate, and that's true. So DOH will encrypt the DNS query to the DNS server, but it won't validate that the response is legitimate, that it hasn't been spoofed somewhere in the middle. That is, if somebody's taken over the DNS server and they're spoofing the IP address that you get back, that's not solved, and DNSSEC will solve that. However, DNSSEC has not proved popular. It is much harder to make the case that DNSSEC is generally needed, although it was much more needed when people could just intercept your DNS query because it was unencrypted, right? So to some extent, DNS over HTTPS means DNSSEC is less important because the integrity of the query on the network is now solid. It's only the DNS servers which are the weak point. And I think likely that DNSSEC will lose its way because it's so complicated. And that's not a criticism of the DNSSEC standards or the process. Any hierarchical crypto standard that has, you know, like even look at what happened to the SSL certificates and how difficult it's been to get that right. And the DNSSEC has exactly the same problem. And if you're attempting to validate that the domain name you're looking up is genuinely registered as part of that domain name, we need a Let's Encrypt type solution that just automates all of that. And that is not what we have with DNSSEC today. So until we can get that next step or perhaps a next iteration on DNSSEC to make it much easier to use, I don't think we'll see it. And I generally disagree with the rest of it. I do understand that there are a lot of companies out there like Cisco Umbrellas who are using DNS traffic as firewalls, and they will need to do re-implementations and change the way they work.
Yes.
But this is, you know, the, and so for every negative you give me, I still see many, many more positives out of this rather than the alternative.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously the folks that have to do these upgrades don't want to take on the cost and the hassle of having to upgrade to support DOH. But if they want to be able to do things like Cisco Umbrella to do that DNS-based filtering, which is a useful tool, then yes, they're going to have to come along.
Now, this equally applies inside the enterprise. So you will need to, you know, whatever DNS server you're inside the enterprise, it needs to be DOH over time. because even though your internal network is internal, that does not necessarily mean it's secure. So fixing your internal DNS servers, I don't believe Microsoft Windows DNS is yet DOH or it's been announced, but who knows?
It's coming. They said it's coming. Yeah, that's one of the things we talked about. Microsoft will back it eventually. They didn't say when, but it's coming, yeah.
They were backing it in the browser. I didn't know if they were backing it in Windows Server.
Right, okay, yeah.
Yeah, so maybe they're not necessarily the same thing. That's different business units with different motivations. And So I do sort of feel that, you know, you need to be getting in contact with Microsoft and saying, when is this coming? Because it is going to be important, especially for VPN and remote users, I suspect.
Yeah. All right, more to come, but a quick break to tell you about one of our sponsors today, Pilot Fiber. Pilot is an ISP that actually cares about customers. They make everything easy. Pricing is all-inclusive. There's no contracts. You get fast setup and installation. You get local support and construction teams. It's your friendly neighborhood internet expert. The products actually work. Hey, what an idea. It's the only access network in the country that has real-time fiber monitoring. No one else combines this advanced technology with the same dedication to quality, reliability, and pricing. Mediocre doesn't cut it at Pilot Fiber. And in fact, Pilot's only looking for technical pros who share their passion for driving an unprecedented end-to-end experience. If that sounds like an interesting place where you would like to work, you can get more details at pilotfiber.com/packetpushers. That's pilotfiber.com/packetpushers, and we thank them for being a sponsor. All right, let's turn to a little news. The biggest story of the week is that Broadcom has announced the newest version of its Tomahawk chipset. This is the Tomahawk 4. Broadcom says the ASIC offers total throughput of 25.6 terabits per second on a single chip, doubling the previous throughput of 12.8.
I really wasn't expecting this. Were you expecting to see this double in 12 months?
I was not.
I was, which has kind of got me a little bit stunned, to be fair. I wasn't really expecting to see this, but it turns out that the way that they've done this is not make a better ASIC that's spinning. They've actually built internally to a single die on the chip, by shrinking the chip to a 7-nanometer process, they've actually built a 2-tier ECMP of the previous generation of chips. So the previous Tomahawk 3, there's now 6 of them in a single chip in an ECMP architecture. Mm-hmm. And that's how they can get 64, listen to this, 64 by 400 gig ports on a single ASIC.
On a single ASIC. Or, if you want, 256 100 gig ports.
Which is astonishing. Now, key to this architecture is the fact that they've actually been able to shrink the SerDes onto the 7-nanometer process as well. And the SerDes are sometimes called the gearbox or the interface. So as the packets come out of the ASIC, they go into the SerDes, serializer, deserializer, so that it feeds into the SFP or the optical module that attaches to it. And obviously at 400 gig, you're now running a 50 gigabit per second PAM4. Pulse amplitude modification. And because it's 7-nanometer, the power consumption is actually reasonably low. This is an extraordinary feat of materials engineering, of chip design to me, because they really haven't respun the silicon, but what they've done is compressed it. And it I'm agog at this, really.
Yeah, it is pretty impressive. And they turned it around very quickly as well. As you mentioned, we were just talking about 12.8 terabits. It feels like last year, you said.
Yeah, well, 2017, I think we talked about the Tomahawk 3 and it coming out. And then, of course, we've got Innovium. And then there's the Barefoot Tofino, sort of at the same sort of capacity. I think the Barefoot got to market first with a 12.5 terabit. And then, of course, you see the next one come out at 12.6, 12.7, 12.8. So they can have the biggest number, but whatever. But 64, 400 gigs or 256, 100 gigs in a single ASIC, which you can put into a 2RU switch. It needs to be 2RU because those interfaces burn a lot of power at 100 gig or 400 gig. You need the thermal envelope to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. But it's still a low-powered chip overall, as best as I can tell.
Well, compared to having to run 6 separate boxes, certainly your power differential consumption is going to be significant.
Yeah, and it's got all the other stuff that people love about Broadcom, or not, as the case may be. Ultimately, Broadcom's APIs are still proprietary.
Okay.
Has there been a change?
There has been a change. One of the big things that jumped out at me in the briefing I got, they are now open sourcing their APIs. So instead of having to license the SDK and sign an NDA, all the APIs relating to switch chip functions are now open source. So if you're a NOS developer, you can see what the functions are on the chip and you'll be more easily able to write to them.
All of them? Because in the past, they've open sourced parts of their API, and they use words like, we've open sourced all APIs related to programming or stuff like that. Is this all the APIs are open? Like in
The briefing exit, all the APIs related to switch chip functions, so however you want to parse that, that's where my knowledge stopped. I couldn't probe any deeper, but...
All right.
So we'll need more detail, but yes, there could be weasel words, but it does sound like they're very interested in getting more NOS development on top of Broadcom, and I think they're realizing their proprietary hurdles are hurting them, so they're taking steps.
Take a step. So I'm just bringing my cynicism to bear here on previous. Yeah. So if anybody out there knows, maybe you can get in contact and find out and let us know if it's like a full open sourcing of all the APIs related to the ASIC or whether it's just partials. Given Broadcom's history here of trending to closed, trending to isolationist and rigidly controlling what people are allowed to do, I'm a little dubious until proven otherwise on the basis of past history.
Yeah, and I want to make it clear, this is not about programmability. They're not opening it up like you can on a barefoot to program the actual processing pipeline. It's just the APIs for the switch chip functions and, again, to make it easier for NOS developers to build to Broadcom and access your basic switch chip functions. Yeah.
Yeah, this is a fixed process, a fixed forwarding line ASIC. Yes. It has a number of programmable stages. Each of the Tomahawk 3s, I think, had five stages, two on input and three on output, if I remember rightly. The big thing here, of course, is that 400 gig matters for telcos in their 5G backbones as they upgrade the bandwidth and for tier one data centers because the less switches you have, the bigger you can fan out. So you need less switches as you get more servers, especially in the spines of those ECMPs. And a lot of those companies are buying chassis today, like Arista chassis, and this switch would replace what would previously be an 8-slot chassis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely one of the use cases they were touting, and of course the hyperscalers.
Yeah, so the hyperscalers will definitely be keen on this, but also a number of routing engines will use it. So while there's still certainly a place in the market for the PTX and the CRS, type lines, you know, the really high-end ones with deep buffers and magic queuing and all that sort of stuff, a lot of people are finding they can replace those routers with these white boxes for certain use cases. So, you know, 64 ports of 400 gig for basically the price of a data center switch, maybe you can just say, I can make use of that and forego some features.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah. They said this is going out to sampling now. They're anticipating having switches available from ODMs and OEMs certainly by the end of 2020. So keep an eye out for next year.
So it is an early announcement. It's not shipping today. So I think this is a big enough step forward to be acceptable. And in the end of the day, the pipeline is long.
Yes, absolutely. Yep. All right, some other tech news. Juniper has announced a new CTO. His name is Raj Yavaktar. We don't typically cover executive moves because who really cares, but it looks like there may be some tea leaves here we can read into.
Yeah, I don't normally subscribe to the hero worship that people put into the figureheads of companies because quite often they are literally figureheads. But in this case, Misty, I think this might be something here because Juniper replacing its CTO is kind of a flag that something internal is happening. And this particular Raj Yavaktar has been leading the Google Cloud team, which would suggest some sort of focus on software and a transition to cloud-based networking approaches. So I think it's significant in that sense, in that taking someone from Google Cloud is saying, we want somebody who's ready to build networks based around software, but knows how to do things at scale and using hardware. So partly this will be for service providers and for the cloud customers. Juniper has a substantial presence in the cloud customers with its routers. But I think it also signals that we're keen about software and balancing our focus on hardware. And we'll talk more about what I learned at Nextwork after this.
Okay. Yeah, I think you're right in that Juniper is very much focused on cloud-based architectures with a hardware sort of backbone, I guess. So this would make sense that this snatching up someone from Google who's got experience with cloud networking is reasonable. I should also note, I looked up what's going to happen to their current CTO, Bikash Kole. He is actually going back to Google as the VP and head of global networking. So a little rotating door between Juniper and Google here.
I want to say something about insular industry where they're all buddies and, there's it's not, they keep rotating chairs. It's like a thing, but maybe that would be a little speculation too far. But it does seem to be a cozy little club, doesn't it?
Indeed.
You might draw from that what you will.
Yes, yeah. That's right. Once you get that VP or CTO level, you can go anywhere. Welcome, that is out. So you mentioned this, Greg. You attended Juniper's Nextwork conference in London. So you had like a day or two to spend with them and get a closer look at the company's strategy, direction, and so on. Are your perceptions of Juniper changed after having been with them?
Yes, I do. Yes, very much so, actually. So this time I was actually in the analyst track. Previously, I've been in the media track, and I've sort of felt underwhelmed. The information you get in the media track is...
I've been in both, and it's sort of like flying business class versus flying cattle car.
Yeah, a little bit of that. So
not even in terms of luxury, just in terms of quality of information.
Yeah, that's right. It's the quality of the experience sort of thing. So I did find myself coming away with a much more improved perspective on the whole thing. And, you know, we've been questioning whether Juniper can change direction to engage with the enterprise for quite a while now. Remember, we flagged that service provider for sales were falling and that Juniper was turning to the enterprise, and speculated that Juniper was turning to the enterprise on the basis of the fact that, you know, as the service provider market shrinks, the enterprise market looks more attractive. Mm-hmm. That's certainly true. But what's unique this time around is a presentation from Marcus Jewell, who's their chief sales officer, explained that they're working to expand their sales network. They're going to hire a lot more salespeople. So you should expect to see more resellers pitching Juniper products, or the Juniper sales grunts will be knocking on your door. Mm-hmm. As we've highlighted several times on the show over the certainly this year, enterprise IT are generally pretty lazy customers. They don't actually want to do the work to buy something. That is, do the due diligence, do the research, know what they want to buy, and then go and buy it. They're very happy to pay vendors a much higher price, and also to pay the extra margin for resellers so that they come and sell it to you. And that is actually the reality of it. And Juniper has sort of been trying to say, why aren't you buying our product? And they've come to the conclusion that the only way to do that is to put more salespeople out there. And that's going to be reflected in the price of the goods that you pay for. We live in a world where enterprise IT appears to be incompetent at buying products, in my view, and this is a sign of that. Now, one other thing that I noticed was Juniper is still developing its own silicon, obviously the Penta chipset, which is the current iteration of the Trio in their routing line, but they're also continuing to develop ASICs in the switching line, which I didn't get a whole lot of detail on that, so I'll be hunting around for more of that in the future. But they're also using merchant silicon. So you can get the open switches running Broadcom silicon, but you can also get Juniper silicon in its own range of switches and make the choice that it is. I think in the keynote, Rami Rahim was talking about focusing on four lines of business. Basically, there's the cloud data centers, the hyperscale economies. He's going to be selling them the 400 gig switches, and 400 gig is a big deal for them because that's where their market is. Then he's got the segment routing with Northstar, which is their service provider automation tool for service provider, and they still see that as a big market, and they also see the 400 gig there driving a whole new generation of sales and transitions, so they'll be in there with that. But for the enterprise, they see Contrail Cloud with Red Hat, opens up the telco cloud. So again, still focusing on service providers at the edge network, selling telco cloud products. This is what I believe to be a largely a false dream that telcos will be able to turn their POPs into small data centers, mm-hmm. and somebody will want to put their VMs in micro data centers at the edge of the telco networks. You know, telcos seem to believe it, and they're going to waste a lot of money on it. So there's a market for it. So there's a product to meet that need, which is great.
Juniper's not going to let that money just go to waste.
No, and neither, and the telcos seem to be very keen to spend it. So, you know, what can I say? But then the final one, which I was very heartened by, is the software-defined enterprise. We know a lot about Contrail in the software-defined enterprise, but this is really a refocusing around Mist. So Mist will still be on top of the software-defined network and using Contrail as an engine to market, I suspect. But they're really big on this AI that Mist has.
Yep.
And for the time being, at least, I'm convinced that Mist is the real deal. It is an AI ops platform that actually does AI. It's not an orchestration tool that's sort of using organic artificial intelligence, shall we say, pre-programmed, you know, like a person wrote a script that does this task sort of thing. And then they're also emphasizing their SD-WAN. So they're basically saying that Mist AI is going to be the future of their entire enterprise strategy. Then they put some stats up on the board to make it impressive, you know, sort of show us that Mist is already getting substantially self-operating. They believe that they're already covering over 50% of operational tasks are being handled by Mist AI today in the wireless networking. And so they're racing now, I think, to get it into the SD-WAN and then so onto the campus as time goes.
Yeah, I'm not surprised they're leveraging Mist. We talked about a couple of product announcements from them a couple of shows ago based around Mist now being applied to wired service assurance, I believe it's called, where Mist can do some recommendations on troubleshooting, and if you allow it to even make do some configuring or troubleshooting on its own, if you're willing to let it engage, assuming you're using the EX switches from Juniper. So yeah, Mist makes a lot of sense. Also, Mist as just as a WLAN platform with Wi-Fi 6 coming down the pipe gives them an opportunity to get back into campus and then use that as a landing point to expand throughout the enterprise. So I can see why they would pin their hopes around Mist for their enterprise play.
Yeah. And this is against the backdrop of the market, I think, is changing to a larger degree. People used to buy their favorite brand of equipment rather loyally. And I think the transition to Kubernetes is disrupting a fair bit of that. And we're seeing a transition away from just buying blindly buying your favorite brand to a multi-sided market. So you actually have a situation where you instead of just buying from the vendor that you know you trust, trusted vendor partner. I think culturally there's a substantial shift here. Instead of buying one size fits all for your data center and shoehorning everything into a VM, it's going to be containers and VMs and bare metal and cloud and colo. And, you know, it's going to be all of those things going forward, I suspect, because you can go back to a multi-platform data center because software is going to help you manage that. It's going to reduce the operational load. I think you're also going to see a multi-sided market. So instead of up until recently, it's always been one company always wins the bulk. One company always gets 60 to 80% of the market,
right,
and the rest share what's left. All the signs are is that we're now transitioning to multi-sided markets with many participants because rapid rotation replaces the long life cycle. So where before we bought something and then held onto it for a decade or 20 years, I think we're going to see a much more rapid rotation. And you're also seeing DevOps, which is in-house talent replacing external support. So the DevOps, NetOps, infrastructure as code means you have to have the skills in-house. So you either buy a SaaS product or skill up internally. And when you skill up internally, that changes the way you can own equipment because you've got smart operators. I've continued to maintain that. There's nothing to change my mind on that trend. It might be a while until, you know, maybe it'll change over time, but for now, that's it. And I see that trend as to what, you know, Contrail and SD-WAN and, you know, the emergence of new products is following all of that trend. So Juniper seems to be following the trends that I see as the future. I'd be interested to know if anybody else does.
Well, speaking of trends, they announced some new products and capabilities as well, including the ability to manage your campus EX switches from the same portal that you would use to manage your SD-WAN devices. Customers can, quote, manage LAN fabrics and configure LAN virtualization and security policies in the same way they operate their SD-WAN environments. Juniper's calling this SD-LAN. Pretty good. And I'm presuming this is based, it's a cloud-based controller. I'm assuming it's Contrail service orchestration, but they didn't say that in the press materials.
Yeah, I assume so. So if it's SD-WAN platform, then it is Contrail service orchestration. You know, can I just take a bow here? Because you've just finished editing my white paper, which said exactly this, didn't it?
It did. Yes, you're spot on here.
Yeah, the white paper I've been writing over the last 3 months basically calls to the highlights the fact that it's more efficient to sublime the campus into the SD-WAN. Because the majority of your campus is actually in the branch networks, not in the head office network, so to speak. Now, that's not true for everybody. The future isn't evenly distributed. But my generalized belief is that campus LANs won't be managed separately from the SD-WAN. Your SD-WAN controller will manage the WAN and the campus LAN as a separate network because that is the data in motion network. And there'll be one other type of network called a data center network, which will be your data at rest. That's where your servers and storage engines are. And it doesn't make sense to have a campus LAN controller, an SD-WAN controller, and a wireless controller, and a data center controller, you know, and a cloud controller for your public cloud. They should all just be merging into just something simpler. And this is what I was predicting. So color me smug.
Oh, boy. This is just what we needed. That white paper you referenced is going to be up on our Ignition site, ignition.packetpushers.net. It's our subscription site for members, $99 a month. If you want to read Greg's triumph, it'll be up soon. Also, Juniper announced new CPE devices for branch deployments. This is coming in the NFX and SRX lines. Highlights include the SRX 380, which is Juniper's calling the highest performing branch SRX device. You get 1 gigabit per second IPsec performance for 10 gig ports and more. They also announced they've got a Wi-Fi card that you can install into branch SRX devices. So if you want to deploy Wi-Fi alongside SD-WAN and firewall at maybe a small branch office or a kiosk where one AP is going to do you, then you have this option now.
Yeah, kind of interesting because the SRX now has the ability to include threat detection. They have a product feature called ThreatSec, I think. there was so much going on at the event, I kind of got overloaded a little bit. But ThreatSec, which means the SRX, turns into a application firewall at the edge of the network, centrally managed and centrally administered, very SD-WAN-like, like this SD-WAN of security that we've discussed before, that, you know, the idea that SD-WAN is just network dynamics. You know, this path, that path, some configuration management, boom, you've got an SD-WAN. This is the phase two of the SD-WAN where the SRX starts to do application firewalling.
Yep. So links in the show notes if you want to find out more. We got more to cover, but just a quick break to tell you about our other sponsor, ThousandEyes. They help organizations deliver business-critical service by providing performance visibility and actionable intelligence from every user over any network to every app, including Office 365 and Salesforce. They've got cloud agents, enterprise agents, and endpoint agents. They use all these agents to gather unique insights on network behavior and topologies and how they're affecting application performance. How can they help you? They can generate performance data through active monitoring techniques from global vantage points. They can pinpoint quickly the root cause of device faults, congestion, Wi-Fi quality, and more. You can share event dashboards, metrics, and visualizations with your vendors and customers so you can work together to resolve problems faster. There's a special offer from ThousandEyes for Packet Pushers listeners. You can sign up for a free account at thousandeyes.com/packetpushers, and while you're there, you can choose a free ThousandEyes t-shirt. ThousandEyes, thrive in a connected world.
A bit of a story there. I met someone this week at Onug. I was at the Onug London event yesterday. Mm-hmm. As well as being at NextWork earlier in the week, this person was telling me that they were finding that the public cloud performance is much less consistent than you might expect. Certain clouds perform disastrously worse than others, and sometimes it's this location of that cloud is bad and this location of that brand of cloud is bad, and they're actually leveraging ThousandEyes to detect that and then bash up their cloud provider, which I thought was fun.
It's always good to have metrics.
Well, you've got to have, if you're going to bash up AWS or Google Cloud or Azure,
you need to prove it.
You need to have proof. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
They're not going to go like, you know, you're not going to be able to lodge a tech support ticket and be, it's running slow in Singapore. That's right. Just not going to get you.
It's not going to get you anywhere. All right, back to the news. We've broken up the FUs. We got a couple more follow-ups that seemed wise to not overwhelm you at the outset, so a couple more to go through. As you know, we've been talking about space networking. Someone had a follow-up to some...
Pigs in space!
It's fun. There was a conversation about getting things into orbit and how relatively easy that is. This follow-up is writing in to say it's only partially true. Getting something into space is relatively easy, all things considered, but getting something into orbit is actually the hard part.
Yeah, he's alluding to the fact you have to have orbital velocity as well as vertical height. So you can't just launch something to 400 miles high and then just leave it there.
Right.
It actually has to be rotating at a rather specific speed. He's quite correct. But, you know, at the end of the day, we've only got X amount of time on the network break and we're already running very long today. So sometimes I just skip over the details and expect you to be intelligent enough to go off and do the due diligence. But it is a very good point. Yeah, getting into, as this person highlights, Douglas Adams once said, getting into orbit isn't hard. All you have to do is fall towards the Earth and miss. While it sounds funny, it's quite accurate. He's actually correct. So, you know, the satellites actually have a very high sideways velocity or orbital velocity, and that's important. He also called out Scott Manley's YouTube channel. Highly recommend Scott Manley's channel if you are interested in some of the mechanics around space programs and rockets and launching rockets and satellites and things. It's quite useful. But again, just remember that in the network break, we're not breaking this down. We're actually just trying to cover the topic as an introductory level and to encourage you to go off and do your own study, self-study and your own self-learning. And really, our goal here is to give you enough professional skills to decide whether you should be investing time in something, not trying to do all the work for you.
Yeah, I'm an English major by training, so don't trust anything I say on orbital mechanics. Another follow-up, this person wrote in to say he would love to see some conversations, particularly on the heavy networking channel, around K-12 networking. For those outside of the United States, that refers to kindergarten through high school, so school networking, maybe an IT roundtable, because there are things like dense Wi-Fi, E-rate, which is a government program to help schools afford network upgrades and so on, because he calls K-12 an interesting beast and wants to hear more coverage on it.
Yeah, I've always been reluctant to look at K-12 because it's very specific to the USA. And the US is only about 60% of our audience, and even the subset of that of people who are engaged with educational networking or K-12 networking is probably pretty small. So, you know, change my mind. Hit me up in the follow-up and tell me that I should change my mind.
Okay. I'm going to take a shot at it too.
Sure. Okay.
You know, we do a lot of shows that may not be of interest to the whole audience. Like we did a recent heavy networking on segment routing. And if you're not doing segment routing, maybe you don't care. We also did a couple of shows recently on some academic research that may not ever see the light of day in your own network. So of course we cover stuff that not everyone's going to be interested in. Also, do they not have schools in other countries? Why would that not be of interest?
Yeah. See, the problem with the educational markets, as somebody who's worked in the Australian and the UK educational systems, they're very different in the way that they approach their buying strategies. And a lot of K-12 isn't about the products. It's actually about the way procurement happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fair. But although I would say that still there are issues like cost concerns, staff and training concerns, working in a highly regulated environment that are going to be germane regardless of the intricacies of your local buying processes.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what. If you want to talk about K-12 and you think you've got something to say about that, hit us up in the FU and tell us, and then we'll put together a group of people and we'll record something where we go through it.
Yeah, raise your hand and we'll put you on the show.
Yeah. Because if you're a K-12 expert, let's get you out there and put it together. We need three or four people in the space. Could be from any country, anywhere, Australia, you know, anywhere in Europe, India, the Far East, wherever you like, and talk about what educational networking looks like in your country. That would be really useful. Change my mind, I guess.
Yeah. Just a warning, if you're going to call in from Australia or New Zealand, though, you're going to be up late.
Maybe we record it in Australian time then, and everybody else can get up late.
That's, yeah, maybe we can do that.
Maybe it's your turn to suck it up.
Fair enough. All right, another FU. This was coming in from folks saying they hear you, Greg, complain a lot about IT leadership, which he thinks is largely justified. So he has a question or a series of questions. Is good leadership hard to find? Do IT professionals just have unrealistic expectation about leaders? Is it a bit of both or something else?
It's mostly just bad leadership, because good leadership is hard to find. And I think particularly we don't train our leaders in enterprise IT. I don't think we train leaders generally. They're just expected to work it out for themselves. We just promote people until they reach their level of incompetence. Now, that is a gross oversimplification, of course, in a very big and complicated world. But the general discussions that I have, like in the technology industry, you'll often find very good leaders around the place. And when you talk to them, or you talk to vendors, or you talk to people who are in the industry, when you get them off the record and behind the scenes and over a good gin and tonic or a beer or a coffee, they'll admit that the level of stupidity in enterprise IT is just substantial, but that's the way it is. They can't change it, and we just have to accept it and work with it. And the thing that I'm trying to achieve by highlighting that IT leadership is incompetent is that quite often incompetent IT leaders criticize engineers as being incompetent. That is, you know, we don't speak the business, or we don't understand the problem, or we're spending too much money, or why did you do this? This isn't what we wanted. And sometimes it's not your fault. Sometimes it's the person who's in control, who's in theory the leader, is not actually understanding what the issue is. So I want you to think about yourself, because you also are incompetent. I mean, the vendors also tell me that there's plenty of stupid customer engineers out there who make unrealistic demands and buy stupid products. Somebody in Cisco many years ago once said, they were briefing me on a product and I just couldn't help myself, and I burst out and went, but this is a stupid product. And he went, yes, Greg, but you need to understand, there are stupid customers out there with loads of stupid money, and this stupid product is to do just that. And he's right, right? You know, like, you could pick any one of these products and pick that out. And so I guess the view that I have is that you shouldn't always beat yourself up if you're being accused of being a bad engineer or not being business savvy, because sometimes it's not your fault. Sometimes it is. Sometimes it isn't.
Yeah, I agree that good leadership is really hard. It's a very specific set of skills. And you're right that folks who get promoted don't often have any training. It's because they happen to be good at a technical skill, and then suddenly they find themselves in a role that requires an entirely new set of skills. The other thing is, we tend to call these leadership skills, quote unquote, soft skills, which I think a lot of people, particularly in the technology field, infer to mean easy skills or not valuable skills. And so, you know, when a manager comes to talk to you, you think this guy doesn't know what he's talking about, or this woman doesn't know what she's talking about because she doesn't know how to configure a switch or write applications, and so therefore is a dummy and I don't have to pay attention. So that kind of, you know, that doesn't help when you're trying to lead a team if they don't think that you have any intelligence or knowledge. We all need to extend each other, I think, a little bit of grace and consideration, because working with other people is hard.
Yeah, but snark is fun.
Well, snark is normal. And yes, a lot of fun, especially on a podcast.
So it is, you know, but it is my way of trying to, you know, use snark to draw your attention. You know, and perhaps the best way to say it is we're all incompetent. But one of the mistakes that a lot of engineers have is they fail to realize that their IT managers may also lack competency. And it's not necessarily completely incompetent. It could be just partially incompetent. They don't know what they don't know, or, you know, whatever hyperbolic sort of verbiage you want to use. You know, whip out your favorite life coaching handbook to apply the appropriate, you know, catchphrases. But, you know, be tolerant and identify the incompetence and then try and work with it, you know, see if you can harness it for the power of good.
Hack the system.
I feel like I'm getting creepy. I'm creeping myself out here.
Yeah, you can
be way too nice today.
I don't know. You may have a whole life coach side gig you could set up.
Life coach by engineering Greg.
Configure your future with Greg.
That's the one.
Anyway, a little more news. This from Palo Alto Networks. They recently reported their Q1 2020 financial results. Q1 revenues of $772 million, which is up 18% year over year, but a net loss of $59.6 million. The company for their full fiscal year revenue is forecasting just under $3.5 billion.
Yeah, the weakness here is that they predicted Q2 revenue in line with current growth and the share price fell 7%. Don't try and decode that. The answer is, in short, that Palo Alto is predicting lower growth in the quarters ahead. We've already seen this across the board. HPE, Cisco have all predicted that the next quarter will be lower as people reduce their spending ahead of the financial troubles, the US election, Chinese trade wars, UK Brexit, so on and so forth. Particularly the UK market is having a substantial impact because it's the second or third largest market, I think, for IT products, but, you know, one of the bigger ones.
Yeah.
And this is having a substantial impact on these vendors. And a company like Palo Alto, like a number of technology companies, are all financially valued on a growth, not on profit margin.
Right.
And as soon as that growth stops, their share price takes a hit. So that's – if I was somebody buying Palo Alto – or considering partnering with Palo Alto, you've got to make a judgment going forward as to whether they're going to be around in the long term. If their growth strategy falls apart, they're going to be in trouble. They're going to have to back off to try and make a profit to restore their valuation. That means ditching all the salespeople, ramping up R&D, reducing operational costs. So tech support would take a hit, product delivery would slow down, and decide whether that threat to your productivity, if that happened to that product in your network, what would that do for you? Mm-hmm. That's something that's on the cards, just like any company, of course. This is not unique to Palo Alto. I think the line I heard this week was Warren Buffett says, when the tide goes out, we find out who's been swimming naked. And I wonder if the revenues slow down for a sustained period. So far, everybody's just talking about Q2. It's just a temporary blip. But if it goes out and stays down, you know, the market shrinks for an extended period, we could see a number of these companies have their valuations repriced.
Yeah, sure. I think Palo Alto is also potentially particularly vulnerable here because for a long time you could just grow on being a security company. And in their particular market, next-gen firewalls, for a while that was a big growth market because it was the next wave of firewall refresh. And so everybody was getting into next-gen firewall. Now everybody who wants one has one. All the competitors have next-gen firewall capabilities. And now we're starting to see firewalls being subsumed into the new category of SD-WAN anyway. So that's sort of a double whammy for Palo Alto in terms of growth until they can rejigger their products to meet this new environment. And that takes a little time, and we'll see if they have the time.
Yeah, that would be my analysis as well. There's nothing, you know, they're not going to go out of business.
No.
The risk here is that if their share price cuts in half because their growth disappears, there's going to be a transition internally.
That's the issue. Wall Street will punish them because they aren't growing. And
that's right. And then they'll be forced to make a profit. And that means cutting headcount, cutting services, cutting products, and that could have an impact to your operation.
Well, we have
it's too early to tell. Far too early to tell, but that's why we're telling it to you.
Forecasting. It's called forecasting.
Analysis, they call that.
Yes, sir.
Prime rib analysis right there.
All right. Well, that's all the financial news and all the news we have for this episode. Thank you for joining us. Just a reminder once again to check out ignition.packetpushers.net. It's our subscription site. It's $99 a year. It gets you access to white papers, including the forthcoming one we mentioned from Greg. We've also got videos, courses, and other exclusive content, all of which is unsponsored. And we're going to be debuting two new courses, including Ansible for networking. So keep an eye out for that. In the meantime, stay tuned for our Tech Bytes conversation with Silver Peak customer Vitech Group on their global SD-WAN rollout. That's starting right now. Welcome to Tech Bytes, a 15-minute podcast that gives you a quick but comprehensive look at products and technologies in the real world. Today's sponsor is Silver Peak, and we're talking SD-WAN with their customer, the Vitech Group. They manufacture and distribute camera accessories for film and broadcast television production. Our guest is Ben Skinner. He's head of corporate networks and infrastructure at the Vitech Group. And Ben, welcome to the podcast. And to get us started, before we start talking SD-WAN, can you give us the sort of 15-second elevator pitch on Vitech, what the company does?
Yeah, certainly. So Vitech Group designs, manufactures a wide range of high-performance products such as camera supports, camera-mounted electronic accessories, robotic systems, mobile power, monitors, smartphone accessories, and noise reduction equipment. We cater for all sorts of industries, from the broadcast film studios to photographers, enterprises, and the independent content creators.
Okay, so Ben, what's the business situation that got you thinking about SD-WAN? What was your setup before?
Before we went to SD-WAN, I would say we're quite a traditional IT function. We had a lot of MPLS circuits, a lot of DIA performing sort of backup to those MPLS circuits. And I think what really drove us towards SD-WAN was we started acquiring a lot more smaller niche companies. Mm-hmm. If you look at the Vitech brands, like the Teradex, the Small HD, and they were more of a sort of a Google generation. So they were approaching IT a lot more differently to our more traditional method.
Because Vitech Group has made an acquisition of a number of photographic accessory companies. Like, you've got 7 tripod companies in here. You've got a whole bunch of bag companies, camera bag companies. Like, these are specialist makers and designers. And you've suddenly amalgamated them all into one business. You must have had to bring in what looks like 20 companies into just one, under one umbrella in a very short period of time.
Well, Vitech itself is actually split into 3 divisions. So you have the production solutions division, which looks more after the professional broadcasters, the BBCs, the Skies, those type of people. You then have the imaging division, which is where if you have an iPhone and you want a Joby accessory, or you want if you're sort of quite a budding photographer, you might want a Manfrotto or a Gitzo tripod. Mm-hmm. And then you have one of the newer divisions, the Creative Solutions divisions, which is more designed towards the content creators, the YouTube generation as well.
Okay. But trying to bring all those together, you would have had some companies which were very traditional in their approach to networks, MPLS with traditional routers. And then at the other end, you're saying that you had companies who are fundamentally born online, working in the cloud type thing, and you needed to weld them into one system.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that made us really take a back step and look at our network and go, well, actually, MPLS has been very good. It's been very reliable.
Generously priced.
But if you go into a company and say, hey, I want to spend £12,000 on an MPLS line to connect you into your MRP system hosting a data center somewhere, and they go, £12,000? That's more than I've spent in the last 5 years on IT. So for us, it's, you know, we had to look at it and go, okay, well, we still need to provide the level of service to the more traditional parts of the Vitech, but actually there's this new agile, more dynamic element of the cloud generation of businesses coming into Vitech, and we need to address their needs, but their needs and also their needs. So that's where we really sort of went, okay, SD-WAN, let's go and see if it will deliver it for us.
So for you, it sounds like before we get into the details of that journey, the getting away from the MPLS and the fixed circuits, it was really about the flexibility that drove you to it.
Flexibility and agility.
Yeah.
You've mentioned, you know, we've bought a lot of companies, and historically that's always been a challenge. Well, how do we interconnect these companies? Do we bolt them on? Do we wait 3 months or a circuit to go in? So we wanted something that it was agile. That was one of our big drivers.
So how did you know that SD-WAN was the way you wanted to go?
I think for me, I historically came from a networking background. So I sort of looking at SD-WAN on and off for a few years, I suppose waiting for my moment really to see where I felt the market developed or matured enough that we could look at it. So, and for us, a natural type was, you know, these new companies coming on board. We want to address their needs, but also our MPLS contract was coming towards the end. So we were like, well, here's a break, you know,
here's a chance. Here's a transition point. Did you find the MPLS to be hard? Some people say MPLS is easy and I know it and I understand it, but I always felt that MPLS networks were painful and excruciating and hard to work with, and getting backups to work was hard. What's your thoughts?
We designed and implemented what we feel is a reasonably good system. But one of the big drives as well from within Vitech was, yes, the system was complex. There was a limited amount of people within my team that really understood how an MPLS worked. And so we were looking to try and move to a solution. And the thing is, they turn and go, oh, yeah, well, you can have this system that monitors it. You can have this system that will tell you what applications are going on it, and this system will help you get your quads done correctly. Well, what if we took all those three or four systems and actually put it as one system, and then you've got quite a junior person then who might actually be able to help manage your WAN. So
you could feel the pain of an MPLS network, not so much because the MPLS was particularly bad, although it wasn't awesome, but also because to make it work, you needed to add all the tools on top, monitoring, configuration management, application performance, cost management, that sort of stuff.
Exactly. And so we're using BGP, you know, across our MPLS was our sort of routing master per se. But that then meant from our backup systems, we then reused Checkpoint Firewalls. We then had to have quite a complex VTI BGP based tunnel, it worked exceptionally well, but it was complex.
it works right up until it doesn't, sort of thing.
We were one of the first Checkpoint customers to go ahead and do this. So it was a learning curve for Checkpoint as well. So it came to a point where you thought, actually, we can make this simpler. We can make all of our lives a lot easier.
So you knew you were thinking SD-WAN, you knew you had the opportunity coming up because contracts were running out and new branches were coming online. How did Silver Peak get on your radar, and did you look at other vendors?
Yeah, we certainly did look at other vendors. I think it's difficult to explain in a short amount of words our journey. So I think when we started our journey, if I keep an MPLS, I'm not going to get fired. Whereas if I go pure SD-WAN, there's a chance I might get fired.
Pure SD-WAN, do you mean you didn't do SD-WAN over MPLS? You're saying SD-WAN is when you run it over the internet?
Pure DIA. It was two spectrums. We thought, well, maybe we'll go somewhere in the middle, in that we might run an MPLS with a bit of SD-WAN, or maybe some of the others. But when we went out looking at the market, we spent quite a bit of time. You know, we looked at Ariaka, Meraki, VeloCloud, Fatpipe, Ari, Silver Peak, and then some of the vendors in between. So our current MPLS, you know, provider, they would have provided an SD-WAN overlay as well. And it's only really when we started to actually look at each of these different products, we realized, our journey possibly then is moving more towards pure SD-WAN. And we did quite a lot of POCs, but we found there was limitations in certain different parts of the product. So
what attracted you to Silver Peak particularly? I mean, every platform's got its particular focus at this stage of the evolutionary cycle. Silver Peak does stand out in certain ways. What particularly about Silver Peak caught your attention?
In the end, we narrowed it down to two products. One was Telari, one was Silver Peak. And what really brought us down into Silver Peak, and a lot of that was driven by my IT team, was the simplicity of deployment, the simplicity of the orchestrator, and the speed of deployment. We realized that we could deploy this quickly, as well as, and we had complete visibility immediately within our orchestrator platform.
Can I focus on the deployment? Because I've just come from somewhere where people were saying to me SD-WAN deployment is hard, and making out that it was extremely painful and you needed experts and only magical superpowers were needed to deploy it. And I'm going like, no, that's not how it works. So when you say ease of deployment, what is it about that really attracted you to the ease of deployment?
Well, we have nearly 20 sites worldwide that we deployed this SD-WAN into, of which we deployed 17 of them ourselves.
With an IT person at the site?
No. So in some instances, we pre-configured the device and we worked with local people And they're not necessarily engineers. We're fortunate enough within Vitec that we have some quite skilled service engineers. Mm-hmm. So we might utilize them. We remotely so just push that cable in, put that cable in, brought it up on the orchestrator, reconfigured our dynamic routing, and we were away.
So you could pre-configure a box, ship it to a location, and just ask somebody to plug in a couple of cables, and then you could do it remotely from the orchestrator.
Exactly. And when we were doing the POC, this was something we tested, because for us, if we do an acquisition, the ability to just throw a box out there and say, hey, plug in. Right. Oh, now we've got visibility of your network. Okay, now we can actually start to see as a business what you're doing and what impact you
might
have.
That just sounds too good to be true. That really does.
Well, when we did the POC, we believed that as well. Mm. And I think it could, you know, taking back to where I said where we started the journey, which was, you know, we're going to sort of possibly just play it safe and have a bit of hybrid, or maybe use one of an Ariaca, where actually we ended up going full, what we would call full SD-WAN, which was pure internet, DIA, mixture of different internet connections.
Now, did that work? What quality of service? Did the applications work? Have you had any pain around that?
No, absolutely. If anything, we've seen a distinct improvement. And what we found was when we actually plugged the Silver Peaks in, the Silver Peaks were actually telling us our MPLS had problems, which our MPLS our MPLS incumbent provider wasn't aware of.
Yeah.
And so
heard
we then
that.
Raised...
Yeah, heard that many, many times. Just about every time you talk to somebody with a successful SD-WAN deployment, they'll tell you that over internet's better than MPLS in just about every circuit. Not always. There are some circuits where MPLS works and you may want to keep MPLS. Now, one of the interesting things you're doing is that you're using the Boost WAN optimization. How much of a difference is that making for you?
That was when we went back to when we tried different technologies. Originally, we had riverbeds. We took the riverbeds out because they're becoming a bit of a blocker. So we started the SD-WAN experience with, we don't think we need Boost or WAN Opt. When we put the Silver Peaks in, we were getting around 70% improvement on our Veeam backup and replication.
So Veeam backups is you're backing up the servers in the remote locations to the cloud or to the data center?
A mixture of both. So mm-hmm. we send some to the cloud, we send some to from our remote locations into central locations, but we also have central locations replicating between themselves for disaster recovery. And so 70%, you think, oh, great, so I'm sending 70%. But then mm-hmm. immediately I'm going, well, I've still got the same amount of bandwidth, so I'm going to start sending more copies. Mm.
When it started to work, people used it more. It's the old 4-lane highway. We make it 6 lanes and it gets slower. Exactly. I want to focus on one issue, which is a hot button for many, many people, and that's voice calls. Everybody tells me that voice calls over SD-WAN can't work. What's your experience?
Our voice calls have definitely improved. So we use Skype for Business, and one of our pain, I wouldn't say pain points, but you're going back to the whole simplicity of an MPLS, is, well, I need to make sure I classify my Skype application so it's getting the right class of service. I need to get my switches to ensure that they trust that class of service that passes to the MPLS properly. So not all voice calls, I don't think, always went down the right path. And if it fails over, you lose a packet and it drops a call. Yeah. Now, none of that.
None of that.
So we classify the application at the application level on the Silver
But you
Peak.
Just classify Skype. You don't have to list out every Skype IP address in your network or something like that. Yeah.
No, just by application, I want you to ensure that this packet gets there as cleanly as possible. And we've simulated it, and we've had experience where we've lost internet connections and the users just don't know.
I want to ask one last question around cloud. So you've got this SD-WAN. You've mentioned that you're doing some backups into the cloud, but how much are you doing to the cloud? Are you actually moving apps into the cloud and the Silver Peak Edge Connect supports that? What's that look like?
So when we looked at SD-WAN, another big part of it was cloud. You know, like many companies, we see our cloud as effectively as another site. For us, it's we're moving our data center into the cloud. So we want that cloud to be seamless as if it was our old data center. So we have instances in Azure. So, and a key part of the Silver Peak POC, and it is now, is to ensure that is performing as well as if it was an on-premise site.
Let me just ask you about the WAN sites again. You said 20 sites earlier. Are they 20 sites in a town, a country, or are they actually globally distributed?
They're globally distributed. So we pretty much go for all the way from Costa Rica through the US, through Europe, into Asia, all the way over to Japan.
And that's all over internet, like DIA, direct internet access, local breakouts, all that stuff.
Exactly, yes. All over internet. And I mean, we have some quite taxing places. So Costa Rica is a beautiful country, but getting traffic historically in and out of there was difficult, but we've experienced no problem. And again, you know, we had the MPLS, we had the internet circuits, and the SD-WAN was choosing the internet circuits as a preferred path because it saw it as...
And the Boost Connect would be very useful here. That you know, implementing the WAN acceleration as needed gives you an extra tool in that kit to make that work.
Yes, the Boost has been very helpful. We still run some on-premise systems and the Boost, especially around NINC, around HTTP file sharing, makes a massive difference.
For sure.
So what else in the future? What do you plan to do with this SD-WAN? Anything else around the cloud or anything?
In the future, we plan to move Nutanix Leap. And as part of that, we're very confident that Silver Peak will play a major part in that as we deploy a virtual appliance into Leap. That will then make our disaster recovery be seamless and integrate fully into the rest of our network.
So you can deploy a Silver Peak virtual sort of SD-WAN node into the Nutanix Leap cloud?
Yes, correct, yes. Mm.
That basically means you can go down to just one primary data center and have a backup online. That's pretty cool.
That's what we're hoping. That's always been a part of our roadmap and our vision for our disaster recovery strategy.
Yeah, maybe we have to bring you back to talk about DR and SD-WAN. That could be an interesting topic. In any case, we're out of time for this Tech Bite. Thank you, Ben, for joining us. And thank you to Silver Peak for being such a valued sponsor. And thank you, yes, you, for being a valued listener. If you like what you hear, you can find this and many more fine, free technical podcasts, along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. You can follow us on Twitter at packetpushers. Find us on LinkedIn, like us on Facebook, and rate us on Apple Podcasts. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.